initial discussion, where has math taken you with you and Kirk? Let me first say a few words. So this is Wizards supported the 2009 fund for the 800th anniversary of the University of Cambridge happening, and so thanks to them, and thanks to Omri, who was the person taking care of our panelists here. Who are? There's Ewan Kirk, who is now CEO of Cantab Capital Partners, and he ran before that Goldman Sachs Quantitative Finance Group in Europe. There's Vicky Pope from the Met office, who is the head of the climate change advice, and was, among other things, prominently mentioned in the Stern Review on the economics of climate change. Frank Kelly from the Stats Lab, professor of mathematical systems here, and also the master of Christ College. And Andrew Cates, who is the CEO, the UK CEO of SOS Children, Children's Charity. And before that, he was the youngest ever senior executive in the Shell Group. So we're very happy to have these four people here to talk with us about, well, where math has taken them. There's first going to be, each of them will have 5 minutes, just a little bit about themselves, their lives, their careers, and what math had to do with it. And then there's going to be a few questions asked by me, and then it's going to be open to questions from the audience and hear from any of you. So let me just get started by asking you to
show. I did part three in 1980, mostly in the applied side, so I was very interested in general relativity, high energy physics. I then did a PhD in classical general relativity, which took me 5 years because I was running a software company at the same time. And then, having done all of that, in the early 90s, I realized I was never going to get a job in general relativity, and sold out and worked for a small company here in Cambridge doing sort of systems design, and then went to Goldman Sachs in 1992 to be what was loosely called their oil strategist. And actually, I had no idea what was going on. Nothing about finance, couldn't balance my checkbook, couldn't discount the cash flow. And basically, the lucky thing was that neither did the traders. And so I bought probably the first edition of Hull and White's book on, or John Hull's book, Futures Options and Other Derivatives. And kind of, I read that really fast over a weekend and started developing derivative structures in the oil business. And from there, we made a lot of money. I ran a big group in energy, and then gradually I ran the whole of the quantitative strategies group in Goldman Sachs, which is about 250 mathematicians, statisticians, physicists, computer scientists who do all of the quant work at Goldman. So that was a good career. If I'd been smarter, I would have arrived there maybe 2 or 3 years earlier, and then I would have been a pre-IPO partner at Goldman, richer than God. But sadly, I was a post-IPO partner, but still did very well. Retired 3 years ago, I had a year off, and because I still like doing quant work, I still like working in financial markets, I started my own hedge fund, which is Cambridge's only hedge fund based in Station Road called Cantab Capital Partners. And I currently employ 20 people, all of them with PhDs in some sort of quantitative finance, and think five of them did part three. So there we are. That's my background.
Thank you.
Well, I studied maths here. I won't tell you how long ago, it was a long time ago. And I escaped before part three, so unlike most of you. I wanted to go and work in research, but I didn't want to do a PhD initially. So I ended up joining the Met Office, mainly, I think, because they were the only people that offered me a job, which is interesting. But I'm really glad that I did, because it's been a fantastic place to work, and I'd certainly recommend it to anybody. I can tell you more about the opportunities afterwards. I was fortunate in the area that I worked in that my boss at the time encouraged me to do a PhD, which was a really good thing to do. So I actually did it as a part-time student. So I think it took, I can't remember, it took me 4 or 5 years, but a long time anyway, because I was distracted with working as well. But it was a good way to do it, because it meant that I was working on problems that were actually being applied in the real world. So when I first started at the Met Office, I worked on stratospheric dynamics, and there are people actually in the department here who work in that area who I've worked with for many years, Peter Haynes, for example. So I was there when the ozone hole was discovered, which was not physically, but which was a very interesting time to be working in that area. So throughout my career, I've really worked in areas where the science is really at the interface with policy, and actually, you know, we're making scientific discoveries and measurements that are, and predictions that are really influencing the way that policy needs to go. And I think that's been something that I found very interesting, and I've got more involved in the policy side through my career. In the 90s, I moved to working on climate models, so I moved down in the atmosphere to nearer the surface. And so we were developing the big models that we use both for weather forecasting and for climate research. And I worked on that for about 5 or 6 years. So really, it's really applying the science that I learned. I don't think I've looked at an equation for many, many years, actually, but it's very much applying the skills that I learned at university in a different context. And then for the past 6 years, I've been doing program management, which is more about looking at the whole breadth of what we do in the science and making sure we deliver what we need to policymakers and the government so that they can make the decisions that they need to. In the last few years, I've been much more in this area. So we work with the new Department of Energy and Climate Change, and also with DEFRA, the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, providing the science that they need for looking at how much we need to reduce carbon emissions, and also for looking at the impacts of climate change. If you were in the session first thing this morning, it was mentioned about the UK Climate Impacts Programme, and we're producing new projections for the UK, which hopefully will help people to make decisions about what we need to do to adapt to climate change, because whatever we do to reduce emissions, there's going to be some change in the future. And clearly, it's an exciting area to work in. We employ a lot of people with maths and physics degrees, so it's basically mathematical physics, but it's very much applying it. And increasingly, we're working more with people with geography backgrounds as well, who are looking at the impacts of climate change, so looking at impacts on water resources and on social development and things like that as well. So I'm struggling now to talk to social scientists, which I never thought I'd do when I graduated with a maths degree, but it's been really interesting to work with these sorts of people, and also working with people who are developing policy. What's quite interesting, actually, is the policy. Many of the policy people in government actually come to it from a science background, which is encouraging, I think, that's increasingly the case. They're not all history and classics graduates anymore, so I'll finish there.
Thanks.
Right, so I did my first degree in maths at Durham University, and I wasn't sure. I knew I wanted to do a PhD, but I'd gone there a year early and wasn't sure whether I wanted to do it in logic and topology or wanted to do it in the sort of statistics operational research type area, which I found fascinating, but which I wasn't quite sure whether it really was that applicable in the real world. And I thought I'd solve the problem of being younger than my age group by spending a year or two out. And so I worked for a consultancy that's now become Logica. So it was a big consultancy in the management, computer consultancy area. And I thoroughly enjoyed that. Really, really, it was great fun. And it convinced me that that was the area I wanted to do the PhD in, sort of modelling of networks. They were just beginning to be computer networks. So I did part three. I came here to do part three in the early 70s. And then I did a PhD with Peter Whittle in the statistical laboratory in Cambridge. And I, throughout that time, I carried on doing small amounts of consulting work with the company that I worked for, and had every plan to go back to that company. And it wasn't until about 20 or 30 years later I realised that this was never going to happen. I kept putting it off because I thought, oh, I've got this is really interesting, this problem I'm working on. I'll stay in academia for a bit longer until a few years ago I realised, hang on, I'm not going to go back. I did my PhD then in what turned out to be early stages of the modelling of communication computer networks, the queuing networks, the network flow aspects concerned with that. And that's the area that I've had my academic career in. I found that really fascinating. It's something where there are challenging new mathematical questions, but where if you make progress with them, there are rather immediate consequences for things like the design of computer systems or the design of the internet or wireless networks now. These things rely for their operation on a quite sophisticated analytical understanding of how large-scale systems operate. You can design bits of code, like the molecules of a system. You can design that, you have to write the code to do it, but how the system as a whole behaves is like trying to understand how the gas in the room behaves. Understanding in very precise detail how a single molecule moves
isn't really the level of description you want to know if you want to understand, say, the relationship between pressure and temperature and volume, which don't look as if they're defined at that microscopic level. And the challenge in the modelling of these large-scale computer networks is trying to understand how to deduce the macroscopic consequences of the microscopic decisions you make when you write routing code or this, that, and the other. So while I was, I became then a research fellow and then a UTO within the university, and I also, one of the areas that I was working on with students here and with people in British Telecom's labs at Martlesham was routing in telephone networks, and that was something where the group of us, quite a large group of people in Cambridge and at Martlesham, had quite a lot of success. We worked out a way to do very simple decentralized routing algorithms in the telephone network, which got implemented in BT's network and in several other networks around the world. And that I found hugely kind of stimulating and rewarding. I mean, it was just great fun to have. It was like someone had given you this massive train set to play with, and you could. They wouldn't let you just change the algorithm. So what happened was that we knew the algorithm would work well. The analysis, the small scale simulations, and everything said it would. You couldn't do a large scale simulation. Essentially, even in those days of the mid 80s, the telephone network was the largest computer by far that we'd ever built. You couldn't simulate it. You could simulate very, very cut-down models of it. But the management were not very keen on implementing a new routing algorithm because, it might go wrong. And then, luckily, something dramatic happened. A JCB digger near the M1 cut through two of the four north-south optical fibres of the telecom, and the chaos that was produced for the next few days made made British Telecom say, what could we have done to have avoided this? And the research labs were ready with their plan. You just have to turn this on. It's actually in the software. You just have to throw the switch to turn it on. And they said, we'll take the risk. And they turned it on. It worked. And that was, one of the most sort of stimulating experiences of things. The academic work leading up to it, the whole effort of implementing it, and then the kind of business decision to turn it on. I guess I got then extremely interested in the internet, which was in academia. We understood, we knew a bit about it. We used it for email, and I can remember three successive years visiting people at Bell Labs when Devassis Mitra, the head of maths there, that asked him, "Are you interested in the internet?" And the first year he said no. The second year he said not yet, and the third year he said it's the only thing we're working on. So that was the speed of the transition of the interest. When was that? I guess that must have been just around the mid-80s. The browsers had just begun. People here were using Gopher and WISE, Wide Area Information Systems. So the web was just that period. So when was that, 84, 85? 92? Huh? Maybe 94. I'm that far out, I'm a decade up, 94, 95, that's right, that period. So Tim Berners-Lee was doing this stuff in the early 90s, that's right, so it was 94, 95, that period. That was the next thing. Well, one of the things I've always been interested in is the application of mathematics to things in the real world. And models of queues and network flow come up in lots of places. And one of the opportunities I had was I had a sabbatical here and there. I had a very interesting year sabbatical in Stanford, much concerned with things concerned with the internet. But after I came back from that, I had a phone call from a set of headhunters who said, would you like to come and be a chief scientific advisor at the Department of Transport? And I said, but I don't know anything about bridges or concrete or motorways. Surely you've got the wrong Kelly. There is a Professor Kelly in the university here who knows all about these things. Surely you must mean that person. And they said, oh, no, you know about queues and networks, and we've got lots and lots of congestion, so you should come and work with us. So I thought, oh, well, all right, this sounds interesting, this sounds challenging. So I had 3 years where I had half-time leave from the university. The university very kindly gave me half-time leave to be chief scientific advisor there. And that too was just huge fun, I must say. It was extremely interesting to see the high-level political decisions that were being made about this or that or the other, and the interaction of modelling issues, data, detailed, sophisticated, analytical insight into an issue, with what the headline of the Daily Mail would be about, speed cameras on the M1 or whatever. If you think, for example, of a transport system, then if you want to add capacity to a rail link or to build a new road, the consequences of that are quite tricky to work out. It's naive to think that all that will happen is the people travelling on that road will get a better performance, because the major effect of adding capacity is not to the link you add capacity to. The major effect in a congested network is to the changes that are made in the journeys that are made by other people. Attempting to understand that involves a very large-scale interaction of economists, computer scientists, modelers of one type or another, and that kind of infrastructure underlies quite a lot of investment decisions in transport. There are many other things. As chief scientific advisor, I had various contacts with the Hadley Centre and with the group that Vicky were in, concerned with climate change. There are issues concerned with biofuels, the impact of them. I've learned a huge amount about atmospheric chemistry, the impact of emissions at high level in the altitude. At first sight, I thought, I don't know any chemistry. Surely I'm not the right person. But in fact, it's quite interesting that a mathematical background allows you the basic analytical tools to work in many areas of science or social science or market research even, just understanding the impact of advertising campaigns on... You can change perceptions, you can change a culture of a society with advertising campaigns. If you think, for example, of the impact of advertising on drink driving, on seatbelt wearing, and now the beginning of the impact on speeding in cities, then it is possible to change a culture. It takes time, it takes investment in various forms of communication. But just trying to understand what the market analysis is telling you, what the numbers are telling you, I was struck as chief scientific advisor that almost everything across all sorts of levels of high-level decision-making involve simple analytical modelling. And as a research mathematician, you can say, oh, that's very simple, it's what you do at A-level or in the first year or two at university. But actually, to be able to do it day after day in one application area after another, you have to have a facility at it. You have to be ready to say to people, well, this very simple way of doing it is what you should do, because I know the next most complicated thing you could do, and that isn't right. Just knowing that the next most complicated thing isn't necessary, the confidence to say that is something that a mathematical background, I think, gives you. Sorry, I've spoken for much too long there. I'm going to stop.
Okay, well,
good. Yeah, I was going to say at the beginning that I thought 5 to 8 minutes was incredibly precise. I think at the risk of none of the other three have landed inside that bracket, so I will comfortably miss it as well. I came up to read maths here in 83. I did part three in 86. I did a PhD in damped, as was, for David Crichton. My PhD was looking at non-linear acoustic flow or non-linear equation theory, depending on which direction you want to take it from. At the end of my PhD, I looked around and for the first time actually seriously thought about doing anything other than academia. I was the inverse, because I always thought I'd come back to academia after I'd done a few years somewhere else. And the first job that I had somewhere else was working as a research scientist in industry. It was a year or so after the Piper Alpha disaster in the North Sea. So I got a job working in explosion research, looking at designing offshore platforms, and it was the fantastic little boy's job. I had an experimental budget of about $750,000 a year, and it was all building things, blowing them up, monitoring them, and having different ideas about alleviating the consequences of it. So that was great. We had a big experimental site in Spade Adam in Scotland. It was very nicely positioned right in the middle of a huge military site, so that if we had anything that went up too spectacularly, you could always blame the RAF who had all of the surrounding territory. And it was great fun. At the end of 2 years, I thought, OK, time to return to where I always thought I would spend my career, and I came back as a research fellow at Emmanuel College, and it was great. And after I'd been back for 6 months, I got a knock on the door from Shell, who'd been the company I'd been doing explosion research for. And before I tell you about Shell, I need to tell you a couple of things about Belgium. The reason is, Belgium is the 11th biggest country in the world. About 4% of the total economic activity in the world is in Belgium. Belgium has about 4% of the world's energy consumption. And the reason why I'm talking about Belgium is actually, on most ways you can measure it, Belgium is the same size as Shell. So although this is a single company, and you think of it as a set of oil outlets, it is actually, you know, the consumer of 4% of the total planet's energy in its own and in its subcontracted operations. The turnover of the company is about the same as the GNP of Belgium. It is massive. And the only reason why I say it's massive is that there are two things about going to work for a company like that. The first is, if you do, as I did, end up running about 1% of Shell, which is very insignificant, you're still running something which would be in the top half of the FTSE 100 as a standalone company. So you're still dealing with things which have got serious scale to them. And the second thing is, it's very naive looking at anything on that scale to believe that it will be a pure monoculture with a single way of doing things and a single ethic and no criminals, and things of that scale don't exist without all of their own issues and variations and so on. So you shouldn't believe necessarily that my experience or another person's experience in a big company of that sort will be the same as the one that you have. I'm just here to tell you about mine. Which is so they knocked on my door and they said, well, why don't you come back and do something completely different? We think that rather than being a technical person, you're actually a commercial person. What we'll do is we'll give you 18 months going around as an international strategy consultant, looking at different Shell operations in different places of the world, giving them advice on what they're doing right and wrong and so on, and at the end of it, we'll find something interesting. So, well, why not? Travel the world. I think I went to 40-odd countries. I did some very interesting strategy work. Quite a lot of it does, I think, still exist as a tool, using some interesting software models on modelling different environments and flows and so on. And at the end of it, they came to me and they said, OK, here's the challenge. We've got an operating company, it's got 300 employees, we'd like you to manage it, but the snag is, it's in West Africa, it's entirely French-speaking, we know you don't speak French, but you'll sort it out, and there are no other Europeans working for it. Oh, and it's a government joint venture as well, so the control that you have and everything is rather involved. So, fine. I went to West Africa, I spent 3 years, I learned French. I now have the very amusing experience whenever I speak on the phone to a French person and they then meet me in person, they cannot believe that I'm white. I speak French like an African native from Côte d'Ivoire, where I was, which is great. And it was very successful, it worked really well. I came back and they said, OK, well, we've got another challenge for you. The next one is, we'd like you to run everything on the globe that we sell to a ship. So Shell has about 10% of the total global market in marine fuels. And that meant, I think at the time, I was responsible for the sales which contributed something like 3% of the whole planet's acid rain. Because most of it comes from sulfur in ships. I mean, it's the acid rain, we hope, mainly, that falls on the sea rather than on the land, but it's still there. So that was very interesting. That worked very well. Again, I made some big changes. It was very successful. I was lucky. I was lucky in Africa, too. And then I had the next set of challenges, which is that I was the electricity and gas market was deregulating. We were moving from a situation where there were large numbers of regulated monopolies. And I was given the European gas and power operations in Shell to manage. Gas in Europe contributes maybe $2.5 billion, $3 billion profit a year to Shell, something of that order. It's a fairly large item. but of course the interests are fragmented across a large number of different places. So managing that was great fun. And at the end of that, I was senior executive, enjoying myself greatly, and then I decided I would do something completely different. I took an 85% pay cut, which is more a reflection of the fact that I was grossly overpaid than the fact that I'm now in extreme poverty. I moved to work for a charity in Cambridge, which is raising funds for basically orphans. So the main source of projects is West Africa. It's quite personally gratifying because when I was in West Africa, I had a number of close friends who had children who I taught to count and taught to swim in my expatriate swimming pool in my villa and so on, who died of AIDS after I left. And suddenly turning around and thinking that these kids were there on the street with no one to look after them was something which my wife and I had been talking about for a while. But we waited until the right job came up and the right opportunity came up, and I took it. And actually, that's been very interesting too. I now have an office of 14 people rather than many hundreds. I no longer have a very large number of highly qualified engineers working for me. I don't have any engineers working for me at all. The challenges are interesting but different. We, 4 or 5 years ago, decided that we would have a major shift completely out of direct mail, which had been the main fundraising that we'd done. We do mainly internet fundraising. 85-90% of our money comes from online donations. Our income's gone up by a factor of 4 since I started 5 years ago, and all of our costs in the UK have fallen. So from our point of view, it's great. The amount we actually send abroad to help kids has gone up by a factor of 10. It's very satisfying. Our trustees are very happy. And although it's at a vastly different scale and vastly different level of complexity to what I was doing before, I still get a big buzz out of it. So I'm very happy with all of it. And I'd have to say, I'm probably at the opposite end from you. If you ask me the question, how often do I draw equations and think about them and so on, it would probably be every single day. But they're not necessarily linked to my work. I'm just a perpetual hobbyist that I'm always thinking about, so I will always sit and, you know, I'll go and read an article on Wikipedia about a problem I've never come across before, and then the next 3 months I'll be sort of sitting, scratching at bits of paper, at loose ends, and doing it. That's just the way it is. You can't get it out of your blood if you do it. In terms of what I practically used in work, the answer would be undoubtedly the thing that you use a great deal is the stats. And the thing that is everywhere and is done wrong and loses people a lot of money and so on is the stats. I think having multilinear regression on Excel is like offering a class A drugs over the counter in a psychiatric hospital. Everywhere you go, you have people who pick them up, don't understand them, pick 5 variables or find 5 variables, draw some absolutely rubbish inference out of them, and then you have the problem about how you manage to persuade them that they don't have a model, they don't understand what's happening, and this is a seriously bad way of guiding what you do. But maybe we could talk about problems like that in one of the later sections.
Thanks, Andrew. And after hearing these 4 impressively and very interesting and diverse careers, one question I'd like to ask all of you is, why does math have such a bad name? All of us here, probably most of us, do enjoy mathematics, but in public it's still sort of, lots of people say rather proudly that they've always been very bad at math. Why do you think of that so, and what can be done about it?
I'll go first. I mean, I think fundamentally, maths is quite difficult, and you have to be quite smart to do it. I mean, maths is not something that's open to everyone. Everybody can learn to juggle, but maybe not everybody can learn to do maths. I mean, I think that's part of the problem. I think the other issue that sometimes puts people off is the degree of certainty that it's very easy to be to carry over the concepts behind a proof. I mean, I remember the very first proof I ever saw, which was the proof that root clues are rational. Right? And I thought that was fantastic, because here was a set of things that led you to an absolute eternal verity. Now, isn't that brilliant? There's almost no other place in the world where you can have something which is true forever. It's just true. Now, sometimes mathematicians carry over that kind of belief in truth into other things, which can be rather irritating for people. But I think fundamentally, it's just a very difficult subject.
Any other comments?
Well, I think people do use it too much as an excuse that if they feel that something's difficult, that they shouldn't make an attempt to do it. And I think, I mean, the education system keeps changing to try to put these things right, to make science and maths more accessible. And it doesn't seem to work. It just seems to frustrate the more able students because they're not stretched enough, but it doesn't seem to encourage the others along. I don't know. Maybe those of you who are educationalists, maybe it may have an answer to this. I don't know. But I think other things that don't help is sometimes the images in the media of mathematicians. There was a programme a while ago about the Maths Olympiad. I apologise to anybody who's good at the Maths Olympiad, but it really did reinforce the stereotypes of the kind of weird, introverted mathematician, I'm afraid. And I think that kind of thing really doesn't help. There were some actually very normal people on that programme, but they didn't use the footage of them at all. They were kind of in the background. And I think because it made good television, of course. So I think there is an element of that as well.
I guess, I mean, maths is hard, and I think that sometimes many people's attitudes to maths are a defensive mechanism about it being hard. I was struck by the times I spent in Berkeley and Stanford by the kind of atmosphere you often got in the cafes there even 20 or 30 years ago, when you find people doing maths on tables, and it was sort of cool to sit there in the open air doing things on tables. And I think that you know, this whole centre here, the Newton Institute and various things like that, I think are an attempt to plug into that, and a successful one, I think. I mean, I think that, so for example, when people come here, you see the teams coming for UK Maths Challenges or something. When the children come in and they see the place, they see the hubbub that's going on at lunchtime, they see people at the desks, at the tables, interested in what they're doing maths on bits of papers. And that for many of these kids that come and see that, they think, wow, you know, I didn't think it could be like that, but I want to be part of that. And I was struck by the notice that I went around about a year ago. Many of you will have seen it from the catering staff, who sent a message to CMS All saying, would people please stop doing maths on the table at lunchtime, because people can't sit down to eat their food. I copied that and sent it to Peter Goddard, who'd always been worried that maybe these things wouldn't be used. And you know something that you wanted to happen has happened when people complain about it. They praise you for it, it could just be flattery. But if they're complaining about something you wanted to happen, then it probably has happened. And I guess another memory I have of the change in atmosphere connected with maths in Cambridge that might operate more generally is one of the Christmas parties that happened in the Central Core. Again, this was a few years ago, and I can't remember now. Was it the time when it was the Jackson 5, or was it the Rolling Stones, the band that were playing? I don't know how many. Do any of you remember this? The band that were playing, and there were some attractive young women came in, and I knew one of them. She was the daughter of a friend, and I said, "Well, it's very nice to see you here, but you're doing medicine, aren't you?" She looked around sheepishly and said, "Yes, we're all doing medicine. We're gay crashers." I thought, something's happened. When you
so you're very
optimistic. Yeah.
And Andrew?
The wider social question, I'm sure other people are better qualified to. The problem in industry is that being right is necessary but insufficient as a condition for getting your point across. A lot of it is around building your credibility and developing communication skills to ensure that you can do it. I've had to sit repeatedly in situations where people have made big, important decisions on a basis which is mathematically clearly rubbish. I can give you an example, if you like. When I was in part three, between Pathway and a PhD, I went to work for Rolls-Royce for 3 months. And they were considering, when I was there, the fate of a computer program which was running mildly supersonic flow between two turbine blades on an RB211. And it was an implicit solver. It had a vast amount of resource put on it. These were in the days when it was running overnight on the Cray at Bracknell, which Rolls-Royce was hiring for the Met Office for £1,000 an hour. So it wasn't when computing was cheap and easy. And in the meeting, they were looking at some of the output from the program, and the output showed two turbine blades with a shockwave between them, and the shockwave didn't go right the way across the gap. Unfortunately, there's an engineering book by somebody called Mr. Witten, or Professor Witten, which states that shock waves contain vorticity in them, and therefore erroneously concludes that because vortex lines can't end in a fluid, the shock wave has to necessarily reattach on the far blade or reattach underneath it. It's not true. The reason it's not true is that vortex lines not ending in the fluid is derived from div curl u equals naught, and div curl u equals naught is true of any flow field you could possibly name. So if you can draw a picture of it with a shock halfway across, then it can satisfy div curl u equals equals zero, and in fact what happens is the vortex lines just fold along the edge of the shock. But I sat there listening to somebody looking at the output from a computer program saying this is non-physical behaviour because this vortex line is neither reattaching, this shock wave is neither reattaching nor going right the way across. And in a meeting, as somebody who was a student who didn't have any credibility and had at that time probably even more limited communication skills than I have now, I was unable to derail the process which resulted in a very good computer program for flow between turbine blades being binned. And it was being binned because of a false argument about it being non-physical behaviour. And this is a frustration which at the time marked me very deeply, and since I've said, and I hope everybody here will say and recognise, we can invent our own rules of proof and satisfying each other when we're in a room of mathematicians. In the big wide world, we have to play by their rules. And their rules are, you have to be credible, you have to be convincing, you have to communicate, and it's not about a proof. A proof just won't work.
Let's try and keep the next answer a bit shorter so we have lots of time for questions from the audience. There's one thing I'd like to ask Vicky and Frank after their research careers. What lessons did your PhD teach you about effective research? Were there any big setbacks, obstacles you overcame? And of course, can you tell us the secret how to do it? Whoever wants to start.
One of the advantages of doing a PhD as a part-time student was that I was able to apply it, and I think and also I was seeing research going on in very different environments around me, so there was in the Met Office where it was more applied, and obviously in the university as well. In fact, I did my PhD at Reading University, where in fact it's very applied. It's the big meteorology department there, it's very strong. So again, it was very much applied to the real world, and I think that was, I found that very useful. I think occasionally we do get people coming in who've got very theoretical PhDs, and sometimes they can find it quite hard to adjust to a more practical environment. But equally, of course, the strong mathematical skills that they bring are also very important as well. So different people bring different backgrounds. The difficult experience for me was not really to do with the science or the experience of doing research. It was more the fact that I was being pulled in different directions. By the time I finished my PhD, I was also temporarily managing the team because my boss was on a sabbatical in the States for 6 months, which was a very useful experience. But it didn't do very much for my marriage, shall we say. But I'm still married, I hasten to add, the same person. But it was quite difficult writing a PhD up at the same time. But I did learn a lot from it in terms of managing my time. Obviously, just being thrown in at the deep end in terms of doing a management job as well as writing a PhD. I wouldn't particularly recommend doing the two things at the same time, but it does teach you how to be focused, I think, as well. So I would say those are the things. And it, you know, doing a PhD is a very focused activity, as I'm sure you all know. You're sort of focusing on one problem or one small set of problems. But you know, when you're working in the sort of job that I was working in a number of different areas, and which actually I find more stimulating, I think, to be applying the science in a number of different ways that relate to each other. So I think it is that balance between getting the depth, you know, the depth of knowledge that you need to complete an important piece of work, but also to be able to look broader at your subject. And I think that's something that, as students, you should be careful to do, to make sure that your knowledge doesn't become too narrow, that you do have a wide view of your subject. And I know people find this increasingly difficult, because as subjects become more specialised, it can be very difficult to get a broad view. And if you become too narrow, then actually, you know, it's very difficult to apply what you're doing and to understand the true importance of what you're doing in the wider context.
So I started my PhD working on a problem called the multi-armed bandit problem, which is a very interesting, it's got a glamorous name, but it's a very interesting problem where if you pull one arm of the bandit, you get a reward, which is a random variable with some probability distribution you don't know, but you learn about. Similarly for the other arm, so what you're trying to do is to maximise your reward, but at the same time find out which is the better arm, so you should concentrate your effort on that better arm. And it's a sort of a precisely stated version of a problem that arises whenever you're trying to trade off the immediate returns from doing things against benefits in the longer term future. Think, for example, of comparing different clinical treatments. It's a pretty interesting problem with lots of applications. And I worked on that really, really hard for the first year and came to the feeling towards the end of the first year that I had gotten nowhere on it. And there were several other things I was looking at, and shortly after that I got somewhere with one of the other things. And when I finished my PhD and I got a job, I thought, I'm going to go back to that problem now, and I'm going to really, really have a go at it. And I went back and spent another year, and I did manage to write a paper there, but I did come to the view that in my first year, I had initially thought that I'd got absolutely nowhere, and after further reflection I realised I was right. I had got absolutely nowhere. And I've come back to this problem repeatedly over the decades. And I got nowhere mathematically, but I think what I learned in that first year was that there are some problems that just are very hard, that you're not going to manage to crack. And it's probably wise to have a few problems that you're interested in, because, the one that you think is just your problem, it just may be one that's going to take decades for more than a few people to solve. So that would be my advice.
Great, thanks. And we'll slightly different question for Andrew and Hugh from the industry perspective. You've both said a bit about how you ended up in your respective careers. I think we'll make this very brief. Do you consider your PhD and research experience useful for the career you have later on? Just yes or no. And then, the follow-up where you can maybe take a minute.
Okay.
What sort of the most important factors were for you to choose to finally go that particular direction and lead research?
Okay. The answer is yes. I mean, it was useful. It was also fun. I mean, I enjoyed doing it. I'm glad I did a PhD. As I said earlier, it was probably the world's most expensive PhD, but I really enjoyed it a lot. I had a very different experience than Frank had. You know, I was given a specific problem, which was the far field gravitational radiation quadrupole formula, and I just ground away at it for 5 years and didn't get anywhere. And then one day I was sitting watching Neighbours on the telly, and I had an idea, and I wrote up in 2 months. So what I learned from that is it's better to be lucky than good. To be more serious about it, I mean, what I learned in PhD was application to a problem. You have a single problem, or maybe multiple problems, but you have to actually focus on that for a very long period of time. Now, generally, you don't do that in an undergraduate degree. That was a good thing. It also meant that when I actually joined the financial community, where most people have the attention span of a gnat, then I could actually work on things that have a little bit longer term. The things that weren't useful, or that I didn't realise, was that the real world is really complicated and messy. I work with data which has a signal to noise ratio of 1 to 100. So one bit of signal, 100 times as much noise. The world's messy, horrible, the data's difficult to deal with, and you don't do that much math. You do a little bit of math, but most of it's dealing with data and trying to clean data, get data in the right format, doing basic statistics. I mean, if there's one thing that wasn't in my choice of courses when I did part three, and indeed in my PhD, was statistics. I mean, I managed to get a PhD in mathematics, and I didn't know what standard deviation meant. Now, that shouldn't have been possible, right? But it was. And so I had to do an awful lot of learning about statistics to get up the curve. And in almost every real-world application, I'll see people going to nod here, statistics is all it's about, because the real world is about data. And the final thing I say, so that I get a chance to say it, if you can't program a computer, you'd better learn. Okay, because I see a lot of CVs from people in university and other places, and they're fantastically smart, but they can't program, or they can program in something like R or MATLAB. For any job, most jobs in the real world, that's almost useless. It's like not being able to write. So you better learn. If you want a job in the real world, you better learn to program a computer and learn to program it well.
What language?
That's a good question. I don't really care. Right? If somebody came in and said, I am absolutely shit hot in Fortran, I wouldn't mind. Right? It's just that they actually care. Right, and they have actually put a lot of effort into it, because it's the way you express your ideas. Nobody needs any more whiteboard warriors. Okay, people writing equations on a whiteboard isn't very useful in the real world, but writing 100,000 lines of C that solves a problem is. And this is very much my specific view. people may wish to disagree with that.
Some reaction.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to be a little bit controversial.
I just comment that if you can write in Fortran, please come to the Met Office. Still use Fortran, I'm afraid to say.
And maybe Andrew.
Yeah, well, maybe would be the answer to the question of whether my PhD was useful.
Yeah.
I'm just smarting for the fact that it's clear now that you wouldn't give me a job. I've never written in the course of my employment for Shell, I never wrote a computer program, and I never needed to. In my view, the added from a PhD and from part three to a degree, and the interesting bit of maths and the real world, is absolutely at the going backwards and forwards between maths and the real world. It's the bit when you do an exam paper and it starts off saying, there's an elephant that was walking along a pavement at X kilometres an hour, and a pigeon ran into its head. Convert that into an X and a Y and a Z on your sheet of paper. It's that characterisation of an enormously complicated issue into something which is very straightforward. That's the bit you've really got to have, and that's the bit which I think is the rarest skill. It is true that in financial data, data sets are very, very big. But in the real world, meaning, if you tried and wrote down the equation for a person, the data sets are so much bigger than you can't possibly imagine the scale of it. And picking the bones out and working out what are the important things in a complicated commercial organisation or a physical organisation or mechanical, to get it into the equations, that's the skill you want. And that you get to a degree from the modelling and a PhD, and part three, maths a bit, because part three is exposure to problems which haven't just been polished by somebody endlessly until you can't see where it came from and why it's that would be my take.
Thank you. So far we have now half an hour for questions from the audience, but you all have 2 minutes to think about this while I make an announcement about dinner tonight, because during lunch some non-conference people ate some of our food, which means that Langley Lauder have been advised to only serve people with badges at dinner, strictly. So have your badge. If you don't have your badge, if you lost it, we'll get you a new one, but you need to have a badge, otherwise you'll go hungry. Sorry about this, but there was a problem. Okay, now any questions for the four panellists? Rocco.
What do you guys think the most important application of mathematics in the next 50 years is going to be?
It's biology is an area where maths is going to have an impact. It's not at all, 50 years is a long time, I don't think it'll be possible to say what that impact will be. But if you just look at what is the raw material of science in that area, then it is increasingly data. It's increasingly relationships that have to somehow be explored with understood feedback loops, structures that have to be understood with limited data. So I think the role of I think the challenges for mathematics there are of a comparable order to those that were presented to mathematics by other areas of science earlier.
If we don't have any other answers, let's have another question.
Six industries. The other application I made after my PhD was into the church, and I was turned down. So that was the reason I didn't go into it, at least as a vicar, anyway. And that was the other alternative for me.
As an undergraduate and graduate, I was extremely interested in politics, and at one time didn't wonder about whether I really would enjoy that. And I have to say, one of the fascinating things about being the Chief Scientific Advisor to the Department of Transport when I did that was that it was almost like having a chance at seeing what an alternative life would be. If I'd been a very, very successful civil servant or politician, I might have been in those discussions, and it was like coming in as a member of your own parallel life to see what was going on. I don't think I would. I mean, because the impression you have of the power you might have, you know, or whatever as a politician is quite misleading. Have very little power individually.
Now, I mean, I sometimes think that maybe I was a little narrow in my choices when I left university. I'm not sure that we had very good careers advice. I mean, there was a lot of information about the civil service, and there was lots of information about doing PhDs, but there wasn't very much information about anything else, and I kind of moved in that direction. So I probably missed out on some things that I might have thought about otherwise. I didn't want to go into finance, for example, but I knew that. So I knew some things I didn't want to do. I mean, I feel very fortunate to have kind of fallen into an area where I've had the opportunity to really develop from doing science to doing, you know, working much more with policymakers and expanding more into other areas. So I just feel I've been incredibly lucky. I mean, you make your own luck as well, of course, and making choices as you go along. But I think at the beginning, I think I was, you know, probably very much in the dark and just very lucky in where I ended up.
Yeah, it seems sometimes that in science in general, I don't know if only in academia, also in the industry, I guess, it's very difficult to balance a personal life with your, if you want to really succeed, because you have to put so much time and effort. So I'd like to ask, how do you balance that? And if you think it's really a necessary condition to give up part of your personal life to really succeed?
As somebody who worked for a US investment bank, I do understand that quite well. part of the thing to remember is if you're doing a job that you enjoy, then it will consume you. You will think about it when you're not doing the job because you're interested in it. If it's fun, then you will spend time in the shower wondering how you can solve that particular problem. That's just what happens. There's a sort of marginal issue here. I mean, even if you work for you work for McDonald's, you're going to work from 9 till 5. Okay, so those hours are, you know, no matter what job, that's what you're going to do. Now, there's a marginal issue at the beginning of the day and the end of the day, where maybe you're going to spend another hour in the morning or an hour in the evening, which is going to eat into your personal time. But you're going to be doing something that you enjoy more than working for McDonald's. The only thing I sort of managed to teach myself how to do was to absolutely make the boundary between the two. So, you know, before I got to work, I didn't think about it as much as I didn't think about it at all. When I left work, I switched off and I did something else. And then it doesn't really impact your personal life as much. But clearly, any we were successful is going to be some difference from turning up at 9 o'clock in McDonald's and leaving at 5. You've just got to make that decision.
I should make a couple of comments. I have three young kids. My first daughter was born in 1999, and at the time, as I said, a rather silly thing, but I was the youngest senior executive in Shell. I also became the first one to turn around to the company and say, I want a flexible contract, I want only 4 days a week, I'm having one day with my kid. As far as I know, I'm the only person ever to have done that. it is possible, but in the end, I think you have to accept, however much people want it to be possible, and however much people have goodwill towards you for wanting to have a life somewhere else, there is a culture where some people are working vastly more hours than they're contracted for, and you are not going to be competing equal basis with them if you have a life which consumes a lot of your time doing other things. And I mean, I already by that stage had decided that I was on my way out 5 years later. I was intending to go out a bit quicker than 5 years, but to be honest, the income drop was enough to mean that you keep saying, well, another 6 months, and it will be... So it's always more difficult to leave. But it is very, very hard to have a good family life with, you know, young kids who sleep longer hours than you do and so on, whilst you're having a serious career where you have vast numbers of responsibilities and relationships and customers and everything else to deal with.
Well, I just like to say that when my children were young, I've got two children, one of them is sitting in the back over there. when my children were young, I worked part-time. And working in the civil service, actually, it's extremely good, actually, for flexible working, I think. And increasingly, I meet people in quite senior positions in government who work, say, 4 days a week, and they're partly 4 days a week. Now, it doesn't mean, I mean, there are certain types of jobs where that's very difficult, and as you say, where there's the very strong long hours culture, that will put you at a disadvantage. And it does mean that during that period, you have to be very focused on what you do and what you don't do. I did get very good at saying no to certain things, and you have to think about, well, I'm only working 3 days a week, so I'm going to do that because that's the thing that's really important to me, to not do these other things. But actually, everybody said to me, and I've just come across this with other people that work part-time, that actually, people said you're much more effective when you're here, you know, on those 3 days than you were when you were working 5 days. Now, hopefully now that I'm working five or longer now than 5 days a week, you know, I can still be effective. But it actually does teach you to manage your time very well. So although in some respects your career perhaps slows down a little bit, and inevitably it will, in the longer term actually I learned a hell of a lot from doing that, and I think it's benefited me in work as well as in my personal life. It becomes more, I mean, the kind of job I'm in now, there's absolutely no way I could do it part-time. And that, you know, if my children were still very young, that would be difficult. And, of course, there are times when I'm not there, when I should be there. And, you know, that can be hard as well. So it's, you know, and now my husband works 4 days a week. So, again, there are choices that you can make. And it's easier to do that now. I think it is easier for people to say, I want to work 4 days a week and not turn around and say, well, you're not female. Why are you asking that question? No, so... It's becoming easier because there are more people doing it. And I mean, I found when I wanted to do it, I was already a manager, and there was a lot of resistance because there weren't any other managers working part time. And I made it work, and that meant that people accepted it. And then other people, when they came and asked, there was no problem about it. Once people see that it works, but you've got to make it work like everything else you do in life.
So it is a challenge. I mean, for the reasons that we've heard, it's a challenge. I suppose. Early on in my career, when sort of doing research or something, then one gets absorbed in a problem and one's thinking about it all the time. And I can remember I didn't used to be very keen on going on holiday or anything, because I was perfectly happy to be thinking all the time about this problem. And that isn't a great thing for personal life, and you have to break into it. Later on, the sorts of things I'm tending to do more of now, that you're sort of meeting people and lots of meetings, and what happens there is that... It doesn't occupy every minute of the 24 hours, but nonetheless one becomes tired of social contact, which isn't a good thing too for the personal life. I think in both areas though, I reckon, early on and later on, I found that if what you were doing when you were not working was stimulating, then that was great fun. And so I think children, for example, are one thing where, you know, often what children you do with children is can be extremely stimulating, and if you choose to try to focus and organise your time to make the best use of it, then it's one way of trying to get a balance. But it's not easy.
That was such a kind of strong applied background, sort of, you know, familiarity with statistics, or if not, you know, just with applied problems. So what would you say to the pure mathematician with no knowledge of anything applied who wants to live an interesting life? What would you say to that
person? I mean, it's a good question, although it's debate. I mean, in my case, it's debatable as to how applied general relativity and high energy physics really is. I mean, you know, is it more applied than group theory? Maybe not. And you know, it's not as if I'm solving Einstein's equations every day. So in some senses, it doesn't matter. I mean, pure maths, applied maths is so theoretical now. I mean, it's not as if I was out there with a soldering iron building a gravitational telescope. And I never did any arithmetic beyond dividing and multiplying by 2, as one does when one's doing proofs. So it's not really that much of a problem. I mean, I think the stats guys probably have a lot more applied knowledge that they can use outside. But I don't think, certainly in my day, that the applied math part 3, or even an applied math PhD in some kind of physics, was necessarily any more applied than pure maths. You learn to solve problems. So it doesn't really matter what you do, I don't think.
Maybe Frank, since you've thought about becoming pure mathematician.
I'm not sure. I mean, your question was, was it concerned with if you carry on doing pure maths as your career?
No. So I mean, you've had sort of all very diverse, interesting careers outside of. I mean, so you may have used mathematics, or sort of, but the point is, it was largely outside of academia, and so the question is, I understand that there's a lot of kind of respect for people who sort of know a lot about statistics or know a lot about, you know, sort of modelling and things like that. Maybe the question is a PhD in pure maths useless for these types?
No, I don't think so.
No,
it's no more useless than any other.
But then the question is, are any of them useful?
In a sense, even a PhD in my specific area, which is financial modelling, even a PhD in that area is not really that useful. Because it's not as if all of these literally 20 or 30,000 mathematicians being paid big bucks in the city have actually been sitting on their hands for the last 15 years. You know, we've come up with some good stuff, it's just not published.
Alex has a question.
So probably the vast majority of people in this room are at a stage where we're feeling very clearly this kind of a tension between an ever-accelerating pace at which mathematical research is progressing, and yet the desire at the school level to keep syllabuses in maths contained in order to preserve the number of people continuing the subject to the level that politicians perceive it needs to be continued to. So I was wondering what the panel thought, given a desire to keep the chain of mathematical progress going as fruitfully as it has been going for the past several millennia, how is it going to be possible to reconcile those two things? Where is there going to have to be some give in the system, in the education system, that brings us from one to the other?
When I was educated in Scotland, where we had O grades or O levels, whichever way around it was, and when I started, there was an O level in arithmetic and an O level in mathematics. And actually, when the government talks about teaching people mathematics, they really mean teaching people arithmetic. And actually, most people are very poor at arithmetic. In fact,
most PhD students are very poor. I'm shocked by the number of people who can't, off the top of their head, tell me what 5% of 500,000 is, like that. And they should be able to, because you should be really good at arithmetic. And I think possibly, you know, the desire for people to be numerate has pushed too many people into mathematics. Small anecdote, sorry to chunter on a bit. Small, I worked with, as a summer job when I was doing my my degree, I worked with this guy selling cakes out of the back of a van. Okay, and he could do like a list of figures like that. He could add them up in his head in maybe 10 seconds, and he was always right. Okay? And you know, and equivalently, he could work out that in a tray in the back that was 6 cakes wide and 12 cakes long, there were this number of cakes, and if we sold this percentage of the cake, he was doing all of that arithmetic in his head. He didn't have any qualifications, but he'd been taught arithmetic. So I think, right, on my view anyway, arithmetic for a lot of people is what you need to teach people, not necessarily geometry. But there we go. Again, I'm just trying to be controversial.
Can I go
with
that one?
Yeah, sure.
For what it's worth, clearly the dumbing down of schools, everyone agrees, is a problem. It's a problem with the people who you have coming into industry having less and less idea of basic maths. But the problem with advancement of science, I think, is completely generic. I mean, my wife's a surgeon, and we have conversations about the number of different subspecialties in surgery and how long it's going to be possible for people to become fully trained as a doctor up to an adequate level across all specialties, when the depth of each specialty is continually getting higher and higher and the subspecialisation is getting higher and higher and so on. So the only other consolation I can offer is I don't think it's a uniquely maths problem. The boundaries of knowledge everywhere are going up and up and up. The only other thing I'd say is probably if you take the gap between when Gauss was supposed to, as a 21-year-old, have a good idea of the whole of the science that was available in the world at the time versus now, it may be that you're 3 years or 5 years older before you get to a research front. But actually, although it's really easy to believe when you're a Part 3 student that your brain dies on your 30th birthday, you can keep thinking for enough years longer than that. It's not a big deal.
I think there's a real challenge for mathematics education, but of course things change, and some things change for the better and some things change for the worse, and I think it's important to try and make use of the things that change for the better. So if one looks at schools, I think it's the case that the standard of maths teachers in schools now is not as high as it was when in ancient history, when I was, you know, privileged to have some really good maths teachers when I was at school. And I think that is a problem for the, say, the maths faculty. We want to attract very, very bright undergraduates who are gifted in mathematics, and the way in which they used to be identified isn't there, because the teachers that might recognise these innately gifted people aren't there. But I think that there are ways to do that. I mean, and based here, the Millennium Maths Project, the Enrich Project, various things that attempt to outreach to pupils in schools who are interested in mathematics is an example of how a small number of people that are in Cambridge can nonetheless have an influence through the web on a potentially large cohort of students who might be interested. And I think that the expansion of knowledge and the generic problem that's there is clearly there, but it's also clear that with things like the web and Wikipedia or whatever, you can find out stuff in a large area rather quickly. And so I think things change, some things for the worse, but then there are other things that get work for the better.
Yeah, mainly for Ewan, I guess. So a lot of the blame for what's happened in financial markets recently has been put on the complexity of the products people were selling and the complexity of the mathematical models that almost no one understood. And maybe for moral reasons, this is going to prevent some mathematicians going into finance. Do you think math has been irresponsibly applied in finance?
In many ways, yes. I mean, the people who were most badly hit by the problems were the ones who employed the fewest mathematicians. Generally, if there's a culture of robust quantitative analysis at the firms involved, then they did better than the ones who
say it's more complicated than that. You know, for what it's worth at Goldman, I have a team of 52 mathematicians working just on tranched credit product, the stuff that we call toxic debt. And those people were super bright, probably between them, they maybe had 250, 300 years of experience in dealing with these things and had done cutting edge work. Now, in that book at Goldman, there were any problems, but that's because we were maybe smart, I wasn't smart enough, but some of them were smart enough to know what the problems were. I think it is going to be more difficult. The golden age of the 90s, where you just needed to do a maths PhD, there were no masters in finance or anything, you just walked into a job in Wall Street or in the city, those things are gone. I'm not sure it's entirely mathematicians' fault. I mean, it's not Fisher-Black's fault that people used his formula the wrong way. And you always used to say that as well. You know, when people lost money on options, it's not my fault. Fisher was a funny man. So no, it's not really their fault, it's how people use it. There's a misunderstanding of basic distributions. I mean, you know, you can be a quant, you can calculate the expected loss distribution for some structure, and you say, but you know there's an expected loss distribution. Now, people will just say, as they said about the shop front and the two turbine blades, I don't believe that. That's okay, we're not going to lose anything. You're wrong, you're just the quant. Now, the thing about giving somebody a distribution is it's got tables and bad things can happen. But somebody else makes that decision. It might be better if a mathematician makes a decision.
Yeah. Actually, I had a two-part question. One was the first part, so I'll pass it up. The second part was, it seems like for the last decades, there's been a growing importance of mathematics in the industry. Obviously, it's going to be famous, but I'm sure you know what I'm going to do. First, is that trend going to keep on like that? And I mean, isn't it dangerous to rely that much on mathematics? Because I mean, there's a growing gap between people who knows mathematics but don't really know the markets or the application, and people who know what's happening in the reality, but they don't really know the models, so they just rely on the numbers that
It's a common thing, you know. These modelling people, these mathematicians, they don't have their feet planted in the real world, and my gut feel tells me that this is wrong or right or whatever it is. I generally find I make better decisions when I use my brain than my intestines, so I'm quite happy to have more mathematicians. But that may not be generally held view, but I think it's a good thing that more mathematicians are involved in more places, in finance, in transport, in oil production, in understanding the weather. That's a good thing. I mean, what's the alternative? Superstition. Don't spit on the magic beans. What do you want?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, my basically maths works, and there's an element of success based on a particular model will make the model used more. So if people rely more on mathematicians, they'll get better results, and that way of managing things will prevail. That would be my...
I was going to say something about how it's applied in climate change, because obviously mathematical models, you know, the physical world, are really important in terms of, you know, how we're predicting the future as to how climate will change. And up until a few years ago, it was really about proving that the climate is changing and that it's going to change more in the future, and we need to do something. And we've kind of got to that point now. Everybody knows we need to do something. And now we've got to actually make real decisions about what we need to do. And the level of information that people need to do that is quite different. And we need, you know, we can't provide exact predictions of the future, of course, that nobody can do that in any field. And it's trying to communicate how, you know, what information we can provide. You know, what the probabilities are, what those probabilities mean, that, you know, the things that we still don't know about, the unknown unknowns, as we were talking about this morning, and how people actually interpret that information. So it's the interface between how the mathematics and the physics of the problem, and actually the biology of the problem as well, how that interacts with the people's decision-making processes in terms of both how they how urgent they see the action to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, and also how they're going to react to the changes in climate that we're already starting to see, and the changes that they need to make in order to adapt to those to minimise the risk in the future. And so that interface between the science and the maths and the decision making, I think, is really important, and I think we're really only scratching the surface. I mean, one of the things, I mean, the whole topic of the plenary lecture this morning was about communicating risk, and how we communicate uncertainty to people, I think, is really difficult, because it, you know, it can come across as just saying, well, we don't really know anything, whereas actually we do. There are lots of things that we do know, but in trying to communicate the limitations of that knowledge, sometimes we end up going too far the other way and telling people what we don't know, because as a mathematician, we're all trained, as you say, for absolute proof, and of course applied maths actually isn't like what it's all about. The statistics comes into it, but even the physical world you don't understand completely. So all of those things need to be factored in and understood by people.
Yeah, I'd say the answer to your question is yes, the mathematics will continue to be more and more important. I mean, the transitions in technology, just information technology, communications technology, that those are essentially mathematical technologies, and as they drive more and more from the physical sciences into the biological sciences, there'll be more and more issues for society, for human beings to try to work out. If you imagine, we're now at a time when the number of bases that have been sequenced of individuals, human individuals, is doubling, I think it's every 15 months. And that is likely to continue for kind of periods that Moore's law has continued for. Now, the impact of that on human society will be very, very significant in terms of knowing enough about your human, about individual's genome, its interaction with things like insurance, health, whatever. That's an example where the kinds of issues of ethics across a whole spread of decision making are going to be influenced by arguments which you won't really, the public or the politicians or society won't really be able to get to grips with those issues unless there's a level of general analytical understanding which comes with kind of being not bad at maths, not just having a basic ability to not be frightened of a model here or of an occasional logical argument that this and this imply that. So I think it is a challenge for society to have a sufficient level of that basic ability to not be frightened of the arithmetic often amongst the general public, but then also people engaged in decision making that aren't frightened of the analysis.
What makes you think that's feasible? I mean, people don't appear to be getting that much more quite up.
I don't know. I'm not sure that. I think we are getting more clever, aren't we? Don't you think? I mean, not maybe in some individual way. If you think of what you as a unit can discover about knowledge, if I were to ask you some strange question about something you hadn't really understood before, I bet most of you, after 2 hours in front of Google, could tell me an amount of information that 20 years ago might have taken you a week. I think there's a dumbing down in certain areas, but we often miss the increase in our cognitive capacity that's coming from other things.
Maybe one final question.
Do you see in the future more connection between the university and the industry? Do you see people from the industry coming to becoming a professor back to the university and the other way around? How is it today and how is it?
I think I would imagine it must be true in other areas, but certainly in meteorology and in climate science, it's very multidisciplinary. We have to have biologists and mathematical physicists and social scientists and people working together, and we're working increasingly with people in other organisations, particularly in academia, but also in other parts of the world as well, and setting up formal structures to make that work better. The kind of drivers and motivators for people working in an organisation like the Met Office, which is part of the civil service, are very different to those in academia. The kind of, the thirst for knowledge and understanding science is the same, but in terms of kind of in in the civil service, you can work on a very long-term project, so you don't have to worry about publishing papers every couple of years so you can get your next postdoc, whereas obviously in the university you do. And so we're putting together formal structures. We've just set up a joint climate research programme with the Natural Environment Research Council to make that work better so that we can actually work together better, understand each other better, and transfer the knowledge from the universities through into the applications and make sure it gets through into the predictions that we make and in the advice that we give to government. So we certainly see it as increasingly important and are working towards that. My guess is because things are becoming so much more complex and you've got so many specialities in different areas that must be more important in industry as well.